Welcome to Infinite Returns, Commercial Real Estate Investing, brought to you by Infinity Commercial Capital. We help people find money. We are investors, lenders, and financing advisors. And this podcast is about real estate investing and helping you. Whether it's investing in residential rental properties or commercial properties, we talk about lending and all things real estate. From newbie to experienced, from funding to the strategy it takes to find success. Welcome your host, Carl Baker.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to our show, Infinite Returns, a show about commercial real estate investing. We talk about all things real estate investing. I'm your host, Carl Baker, a real estate investor, a licensed CPA for over 30 years, and the CEO of Infinity Commercial Capital, the show's sponsor. At Infinity Commercial Capital, we help people find money. We represent borrowers. We are lenders and financing advisors. More about us later at the end of the show. Before we get started, if you are watching this via YouTube or some sort of video platform, make sure you follow that platform if you want to continue or follow our show if you want to continue receiving our content. If you're listening through a podcast stream, then make sure that you follow that show and we will continue to bring you content, and looking forward to that. Thanks very much. Today, I'm super excited about our guest, Justin Shore. Justin is a friend of mine and a client of ours, but really he's a friend, and I think you'll see by the end of this, he is a wealth of knowledge. I've really been looking forward to speaking with him. We're going to talk about tax planning, business structures, all things real estate in terms of some setup that one should do. Very quickly, he is a tax advisory manager with Hall CPA, also known as the Real Estate CPA. I've referred clients to them. They're a national virtual CPA firm across the country. Here's what I know about Justin and the firm that he works with. The Real Estate CPA focuses on helping real estate investors grow their businesses by making proactive decisions through tax planning, tax preparation, and accounting services, all things that we'll actually talk about today. Justin also has been investing in real estate for nearly a decade via his own portfolio, as well as through small and medium scale partnerships. Justin, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me on, Carl.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more. Give us some other insights about you.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I've been practicing for, I'd say about 12 years now, like Carl said, doing, you know, real estate investments of my own for 9-10 years. I've always just been really passionate about real estate, you know, partially from the investment pathway. Of course, you know, my background being in taxes, I was very attracted to it for all of the intense tax benefits as well. So that's what always kind of drew me to it. And I've been fortunate enough over the last several years, I've been able to specifically focus on nothing but real estate all day, day in and day out. And that's what my entire team here does as well, is we work on coaching clients through strategies that are the most relevant and, you know, and useful to them to help them grow their real estate portfolios and in some form or fashion achieve some level of financial freedom.
Well, one thing that I can say, and I've said this to you before, but Justin makes taxes cool. He's very passionate and very enthusiastic and articulate and knowledgeable about tax-related tax-related issues. And we'll have him back on sometime to dive into some tax-specific issues, maybe at the right time. But one of the things that I like about your approach is to educate clients about the difference between tax planning and tax preparation. Huge difference. There's a time and a place for everything, and there is timing for everything. So we could dive into that, and I know we have some things we want to talk about. But I just love when in your introduction we talk about it. I just think it's so important to understand that difference. So
absolutely,
quick comment about that.
Yeah, you know, and I could give you some almost kind of like an anecdotal references. We talk to, you know, just dozens of clients every month, and a lot of people that are using our services. One of their comments a lot of times is that, you know, I have a, you know, tax professional, tax preparer, but they're not really proactive with me. You know, they kind of file my tax return every year, but I'm not really getting advice ahead of time. And I think that's where we have to really point out that, again, the difference there between, you know, someone who is, there's a lot of people that are great at preparing tax returns, but don't really have much of a focus on actual tax planning. And that's not necessarily, you know, their fault. That might just be, you know, what they're focused on or what they're best at. But that's where we would encourage, you know, all of our clients to, you know, look for someone who can be both, or if they can't be both things, you know, look for, it's okay to have, you know, an advisor who's a tax planner, and then also have your tax preparer. They might be the same person, they may not, but ultimately at the end of the day, where you're going to be able to reap the most benefits, save the most money on taxes, is by doing more of the forward looking, the actual tax planning, figuring out what you can do ahead of time, because there's a minimal amount of things that you can do after the tax year is over, you know, actually during tax season, but it's pretty limited. Your options are just far more vast if you're actually planning forward and trying to think things out ahead of time. And especially figuring out if there's more than one pathway that you can take. A lot of times our clients aren't aware until we start kind of briefing them in on all the options that they have, that there might be two different roads they could go down, or three, to ultimately get to the same goal that they're trying to achieve.
Right. Well, I guess I would say you touched on this, but when we talk about timing in tax planning, that could be before or after year end, but it could also be before or after a transaction, and right. how you might enter into a transaction or plan to navigate through a transaction with a plan, with a tax advantaged plan, and knowing that before is super important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, very good. I just wanted to touch on that because I think it's important, and it highlights the difference between tax preparation and tax planning. So I just wanted to talk about what we wanted to do today is navigate through a few talking points relating to taxes, related to business, corporate business setup, you know, under the umbrella that, if we understand that being a real estate investor is a form of a business, it's it is a form of a business. Many people go into it for the wealth appreciation, for the wealth portfolio that might come from it. They want financial freedom, et cetera. But there's still a professional approach that should be undertaken. And so what we wanted to do was navigate through some of those things that you should be thinking about. It will be tax oriented, but it won't all be tax oriented. So wanted to do that. First thing, let's just talk about the overarching concept, business overview. Why invest in real estate? Why would a person invest in real estate, Justin?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different reasons that that different investors will get into it. But I would say kind of the common thread is that, you know, I typically hear, and this is even, again, since I'm an investor, also something that's kind of also near and dear to my heart, or you could say I definitely practice what I preach, is that I think initially a lot of us get into it for wanting to develop some kind of passive income stream. You know, there's a huge attraction to that as far as being able to have a supplementary income stream that, I don't want to say it's not any work. It's definitely some work. Like you said, it is a business that you have to run, so you have to put a little bit of work into it. But you know, as far as what we would kind of consider to be a W-2 day-to-day job versus something that's more passive, real estate can be really great for facilitating that. It's to kind of expand on that a little bit, you know, I would say the majority of our clients are doing real estate, quote unquote, on the side. You could say of they have some kind of profession, some kind of W-2 job, or maybe they're self-employed and have another kind of business, you know, whether they're running their own dental practice or electrical contracting business or something like that. But it's very, very common for people to have that real estate portfolio sort of on the side. But also another big one that I hear is it's a great way for building long-term wealth because of the tax advantages. And also what a lot of investors, I think, are looking to utilize it for is a way to supplement retirement a little bit while at the same time diversifying. You know, I think most of us are familiar with the general ideas of like having a 401k, IRAs, like traditional retirement plans. But what I think a lot of people will also kind of look at real estate for is sort of an alternative retirement plan as well, in the same vein that it's going to provide you some of that relatively passive cash flow for your retirement, for you to actually be able to live off of, in addition to just your traditional retirement accounts too.
Right. Under that concept, if you have a handful of rental properties, and if you choose at some point in your life to have no debt on those, then that income stream could become relatively passive. And as long as mm-hmm. the economy is there and there's still a market for rental tenants, then that can be akin to receiving a dividend every month if you compare mm-hmm. it to a stock portfolio. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, you could potentially have property managers, you know, kind of handling the day-to-day operations for you so that you're a little bit more removed at that point in time. And the phrase a lot of people use is mailbox money, where you're essentially just getting those, like I said, kind of like a dividend check, where you kind of let a property manager handle all that day in, day out stuff so you don't have to deal with tenants, toilets, and trash.
Right. You have to like being in that if you want to deal with those things at some point. Mm-hmm. Well, so as we think about or ask people to think about why they want to be in real estate, let's talk about what are some of the high level tax advantages that mm-hmm. one can get from having a real estate portfolio.
Yeah, I'm going to take a kind of an odd one first, as far as like the typical order most people would think of with tax advantages in real estate, because okay. I want to mention from just a high level the concept of 1031 exchanges. And we probably don't have time today to get into all the nitty gritty. Maybe that'll be something that we dive into more in depth in like a later episode or something. But what right. you need to know from a high level with 1031 exchanges is that if you were to sell a property at a large gain, you would recognize that gain. And in general, if you sell it, you're gonna have to pay taxes on that gain. The beauty of the 1031 exchange is it allows you to defer the recognition of that income by mm-hmm. reinvesting those proceeds into another property. So if you kind of compare this to say, what if I just make investments through my brokerage account? You know, I'm really good at like say trading stocks. The problem is with any kind of stock trades is every single time that you earn some kind of gain, maybe say whether it's short-term gain or long-term capital gain on the sale of stocks, it's going to be taxable in that year that you recognize it, unless you have some kind of losses from stock trades that right. you can use to offset it. But in that point, then you're not making any money, right? So what's great about 1031 exchanges is they only apply to real estate. So this is why I'm kind of contrasting it to a brokerage account. But with the 1031 exchange, you could defer that recognition of that income by making that reinvestment. So it's really unique to real estate in that you can do that. You can make that qualifying reinvestment as long as you do it within prescribed timelines. And effectively, you can compound that effect over your lifetime. So maybe this is over 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. It could be that you start with just one property and it appreciates in value. You sell it for a large gain. You roll that into a property that's even larger. And you essentially can rinse and repeat that over and over again every few years as those properties go up in value. So a big contrast to that is all of those gains, as long as you do it correctly, could wind up being essentially non-taxable really for the course of your lifetime. You know, as a lot of people say, that, you know, death and taxes are something you can't escape. I would caveat that with you can escape some taxes through death and that you could do these 1031 exchanges in perpetuity, essentially. And one of the unique things that you can do is if you pass your real estate down to your heirs, to your children, all of that deferred gain, that deferred tax that you kept postponing via 1031 exchanges can actually all be wiped clean if you leave that property to your lineal descendants, essentially. So it is actually possible to fully defer and get rid of that, really eliminate that tax entirely. So very unique to real estate for sure.
I can see why you would start with that, because that's huge. First of all, let's back up a little bit, just to contrast a few things. Let's contrast, and not to dwell on this, but just to lay some framework. Mm-hmm. If a person has a W-2 job and they take that W-2 job and have some savings, they're going to pay an income tax on that W-2 job. And if they have a decent living, they might be paying on a progressive tax level at the 25, 28, 36% rate. Even without a 1031 exchange, once they sell a property for a profit, and just, we'll just keep it now at, you sell it for more than you paid for it. And you'll introduce a concept here in a minute about depreciation. But very simply, if you sell it for more than what your cost basis is, you have a profit. That capital rate, even if without a 1031, one of the tax advantages would be that you would pay a lower tax rate than you would on a W-2 job, based on the lower rates for capital gains tax, right? And then on top of that, you can defer that, you just described, potentially forever if you do it the right way through a 1031 exchange.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. The long-term capital gains rate caps out at 20%. There's potentially net investment income tax that gets added on top of that. So it'd be 23.8, but comparing that to the top tax bracket right now is 37, which it's actually slated to go up to 39.6 here in 2026. So that's just around the corner, assuming that Congress doesn't change its mind between now and then. But that's a pretty big delta. Right. That's a pretty big differential there. I mean, you're talking about 13 to 15% difference. Yeah, even if you don't do the 1031 exchange, very advantageous.
And it's important to know you have to do this professionally. You can't just say I'm going to do a 1031 exchange. You have to hire people, navigate through a formal process. Which I know you wanted to keep it high level, but just be aware, you don't just trip into that. You do have to enter into a process for that. But it's one of
my cornerstones that I always say is that there's equal to, if not more, planning that goes into selling a property than goes into buying a property, for sure. At least on the tax planning side.
Yeah, that's a great piece of advice, because guaranteed. When you are doing high level conversations with people and you listen to mentoring programs and stuff, that never comes up. So that's a great point. All right. So let's talk about your next point, introducing the concept of depreciation and how that helps in how that provides a tax advantage.
Absolutely. Yeah. So depreciation, and you know, we have to clarify a little bit here too. Generally, when we're talking about real estate over the long term, it typically appreciates, right? The longer you stretch out that time horizon, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, the more, you know, of a definite that becomes, and that the value is most likely going to go up over the long term. So we got to separate our minds a little bit from that of, we're not talking about just like the increase or decrease in value, but depreciation is a tax deduction that you're allowed to take for the expected wear and tear on a building. And there's various different speeds you can think of as far as, you know, how quickly you can take depreciation on a building. Now, if we're just talking about typical residential types of property, the IRS puts that on a 27.5-year schedule. Oddly specific, 27.5. Not exactly sure how they came up with that exact number.
Right.
But it equates to a little bit more than 3.6% of depreciation that you get to take every year. So real, like, simple example there, if it's a, say, $200,000 property or $200,000 building value, your annual depreciation on that would be around $7,200, $7,300. That would be just a tax deduction that you get to take on your return, in addition to all of the other operating deductions like insurance, property taxes, repairs, anything else that you need to actually run the property. So that's what a lot of times we would refer to that as what can be referred to as a paper loss. Because that deduction is based off of the purchase price, the original cost basis of the property that you have. The key there is that you'll notice that I didn't mention anything about how much debt you have or what your down payment was or how much equity that you have in the property. It's all based off of that purchase price. And we also have to consider land value in there as well. But So the main point there being is it's possible that depending on what your actual net operating income or what you'd think of as your cash flow, you can have positive cash flow on a property while at the same time showing a tax loss. And that's because of this depreciation concept. So to take that a step further, because you might be thinking, okay, you know, that's great. I can take $7,300, $7,400 worth of deductions. What if my, you know, what if my property is really profitable and I'm making, you know, $10,000 each year off of it before I take that depreciation? I'm not in a lost territory. One, I would say it's still great. It's still a huge advantage that you're able to take those deductions because that means you're shielding $7,300 out of the $10,000 of cash flow you had from taxation. So you're drastically reducing your tax rate on the income from the property. And let's not forget that the property is probably slowly going up in value at the same time. But the what we can do is we can utilize a cost segregation study. And the purpose of the cost segregation study is to figure out what chunks of the building have shorter lifespans than 27 and a half years. And typically, again, there's a lot of different asset classes. So there's a lot of different class types of property that you can find. But to kind of keep it more, you know, I would say like typical here, if we're talking about a typical residential property, like a single family home, something along those lines, then the two additional classes we would normally see is 5 and 15 year depreciation. The reason why we want to find those and figure out how much those are is not just because 5 and 15 is faster than 27 and a half years, but they are eligible for bonus depreciation. Bonus depreciation is what you can think of. We would say it's an accelerated form of depreciation, meaning that we can take it much faster. Now, depending on the year and the tax law that's in place currently at the time, right now, as we're recording this in January of 2024, the bonus depreciation rate is 60%. There's some pending legislation that might change that in a few months. We're not holding our breath, but we'll cross our fingers. It could go up to back up to 100%. But again, kind of using our same example, if we have $200,000 of a building value, where when we do this cost segregation study, just on average, kind of ballpark estimate, I would expect there to be, you know, in the neighborhood of, say $40,000 to $50,000 of bonus eligible property. That would be 5 and 15 year property values. So if we're looking at $40,000 to $50,000 of bonus eligible property, and we can take 60% of that as bonus appreciation, that means we can take 60% of it all in the first year. So that would be $24,000 to $30,000 in accelerated depreciation deductions. So again, doesn't matter how much we've necessarily invested in that property, we might be able to accelerate in excess of $30,000 worth of depreciation deductions just in the first year. That's where you can start generating some significant quote unquote paper losses, because these are not operating losses, they're just tax losses.
Yeah, well, they there's a lot there, but you can see how there are some major tax advantages, because one of the things you said earlier, it's a truth that many people are into real estate on the side. So let's say they have 100, 200, 50,000, some sort of a W-2 job, or maybe they have another business. They're all other thing. If they didn't have this, they would be paying taxes on the progressive tax rate schedule, and going through that the tax return, and they would owe some taxes. What you're saying is that because of some of this depreciation, they would have a lower amount of taxable income from their other regular source of earnings, and they would have less taxes owed from this bonus depreciation, especially. We could get later into the concept of a real estate professional, but that bonus depreciation, as I understand it, is allows you to take those losses against your other income if you have if this is a side job for you. I think that's important to understand.
Yeah, potentially. There's a few other boxes that you've got to check in order to be able to, say, do something like offset W-2 income. But yeah, okay. It's possible to utilize those business losses to offset W-2 income if you're using something like qualifying as a real estate professional, or you have your spouse qualifying as a real estate professional, Or you could be using the tapping into the short-term rental exception. Often people use the word loophole when they're referring to that because it's an exception to the real estate professional status rules.
Well, so let's, so I tripped over a couple things that we're going to talk about, but let's stick to the cost segregation. You told me offline, and I hadn't heard this before. It's fascinating. You told me offline that there are some misnomers out there that even people's tax preparers have advised them to do. So let's talk about that briefly, and then let's move into the short-term rental loophole and the real estate professional designation.
Sure.
So the misconceptions, you said that you all, your firm, and you receive calls all the time from new clients that have said that their prior tax professional has told them not to do a cost seg study, not claim depreciation. And you know, I'm a licensed CPA. I'm not a tax planner like you are. My background is more related to corporate processes and auditing, et cetera. But I know enough about taxes to know that my jaw dropped when you told me that that is out there. So talk about that, why that is. And I hope that somebody hears this. And if they've heard that before, to question that and to give you a call, frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully you get some people turning the volume knob up on this part of the conversation when they hear this. Yes. So I'll start with the simpler one. We hear this sort of rebuttal, so to speak, or this objection, where the client says, hey, you know, well, my last, you know, tax preparer, my last CPA told me that I shouldn't take depreciation at all, because if I do, I'm going to have to, quote unquote, pay it back. That's kind of the phrase that we hear a lot of times. And so I feel like we need to at least first off explain like where this is coming from, like where that idea comes from. And what it stems from is that if you buy a property and you depreciate it, say over the course of, you use that, we'll just ignore cost segregation study, you just take that straight line 27 and a half year depreciation, kind of the boring run of the mill depreciation, that's kind of slow. If you do that over the course of 5 years and go to sell the property, well, we talked about the fact that hopefully the property is going up in value a little bit every year. So you're probably going to have some capital gains from the sale. But what we haven't covered yet there is the concept of depreciation recapture. And the depreciation recapture is just a fancy way of saying that any depreciation that you took during the lifespan of owning that asset, owning that rental property, that when you sell it, you'll have to pick that back up as income. You have to recognize all that depreciation as income. So this is where people get the idea of quote unquote paying it back, is that, okay, I took all these deductions, which lowered my tax liability in prior years, but now it's going to get added back to my income, which means I'm going to have to incur additional taxable income and therefore additional taxation. Now, again, aside from, you know, the idea of 1031 exchanges being able to eliminate that potentially entirely, that's one thing. But let's just say you don't do a 1031 exchange because you don't want to reinvest into another property. So you're just outright selling it. So that's where the idea comes from of, oh, I've got to pay back this depreciation. That is true. You would have to recognize that as income. So before we get into the other points on this, though, here, too, is the, if we kind of break that down into like what exactly is happening there, like let's say over the course of several years, I take $40,000 worth of just straight line depreciation. And that is every single year that I'm taking little pieces of that, it is decreasing the amount of taxes that I owe, whether it's offsetting my rental income, and or maybe I'm qualifying as a real estate professional, so it's offsetting my spouse's W-2 income, something like that. The main point being there is we're saving money on taxes while we're holding that asset. So let's say over the course of that, you know, that time, I take those $40,000 worth of deductions, and I'm in, I'll say kind of in the middle of the road, 32% tax bracket. That means that I'll have saved, what is that, $13,600 in taxes. Now, the big question is, what did you do with the $13,000 of tax savings during that 5 years? Well, and we're talking about investing here, right? So I like to think that at least some, if not all of that, is maybe being reinvested into whether it's real estate or stocks that are generating some kind of return or bonds or anything like that. Main point being is that that's extra money you're keeping in your pocket instead of giving it to Uncle Sam, instead of giving it to the government in the form of taxes. And what you do with that is, let's say you're generating, I don't know, 10% annual rate of return over the course of that period, over each year. If that's the case, then maybe you're generating an extra $1,300-$1,400 every year on that reinvested tax savings. So yes, you maybe get 5 years down the road and you have to pick that back up as income and pay that $13,000 back. But during the course of that 5 years, maybe that has enabled you to earn an extra $6,000 or $7,000 or so. Now, at that point in time, sure, we pay that money back. But the reason why I really like that people use this phrasing all the time of I have to, quote unquote, pay it back is, what does that sound like? It sounds like a loan, right? You take a loan out, you have to pay it back. But what have we done there? During that time period while we were holding that asset, we weren't having to make principal payments to the government on those tax savings, right? We weren't having to make interest payments on those at all. So what we effectively just did over the course of that 5 years is we took all these tax savings through this mechanism and we've generated some return with it. And yes, at the end of that 5 years, when I sell the property, I have to pay it all back. But what I just did is I took a no interest loan from the government that had one balloon payment at the end, which was a point that I could control, by the way, because I decided when I wanted to sell the property. So for all of our investors out there, if you could take a no interest loan with no principal payments until the balloon payment date, who wouldn't take that that loan? Right. So even in the worst case scenario, no 1031 exchange or anything, and we just recognize all the taxes at the tail end, you've still massively benefited on the time value of money on that investment of those savings.
Which is fantastic. And what a great explanation, Justin. Mm-hmm. I think that time value of money concept applies. Why pay taxes until you have to? The concept of paying taxes now because you have to pay for it eventually. Well, the whole point of tax planning is to defer that as long as possible and to keep control of your funds. And if you can put a plan in place to not pay those taxes yet, why wouldn't you? To maintain liquidity, to put those monies into better use, like you said. So makes complete sense to me. I'm sorry that that is out there. And hopefully that can dispel some of those misnomers out there.
The other thing almost, I forgot to mention this. I got to squeeze that in there. Sorry to interrupt you, Carl, is that the wild thing here is the other part of that phrase here. A lot of clients say my previous, you know, tax professional told me not to claim depreciation at all, is that under this premise that, like, oh, if you don't take depreciation, you'll be better off because you won't have depreciation recapture and have to pay it back. The misnomer there is that if the IRS will assume that you took the depreciation, whether you took the deductions or not, and this comes as a huge shock to a lot of investors who have had, you know, CPA for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, telling them, no, don't, we're not going to take depreciation because you'll have to pay it back, is when you go to sell that property, the IRS will charge that expected depreciation back to you as income, whether you took it or not, because this is very well delineated in the tax code, because when it's talking about depreciation recapture, it says that you have to recapture the depreciation that was allowed or allowable. It does not say how much you took in depreciation, but how much was allowed. So that means if you took zero, but you were allowed to take 50,000, they're going to make you pay back 50,000 depreciation. So that can be really rubbing salt in the wound if you find out you've got to pay it back and you actually never even took the deductions in the first place.
My goodness. Fairly unfathomable, but leave that to the IRS to do that.
Luckily, there's a way to fix it, and we do that a lot.
Oh, well, good. We'll dangle that carrot there, and mm-hmm. people will know how to find you. All right, so we've been talking for a while now. I'm going to pick up on two or three things from our remaining talking points. I'd like for you to explain the real estate professional status concept, because I think that's important for people to understand. Mm-hmm. So I'd like for you to talk about that. We're probably not going to talk about the short-term rental loophole at this point, but I do want to give you an opportunity after we talk about that. I'd love to talk about bookkeeping and those sort of things, but I'm going to table that. Mm-hmm. Let's end with the real estate professional and then let you give some heads up on current changes and pending legislation.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have to preface the real estate professional status concept for, I always kind of like to start with, like, why does it matter? Like, why do we care? And the basis for it is that back in 1986, which was the last major tax overhaul we had before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017. But back in 86, Congress established these two different categories of income, and all income you can have from no matter what source falls in one of these two categories, and they're non-passive and passive. So just like with income falling in one of those two buckets, losses fall into one of those two buckets as well. And what they did is they outlined the concept that rental losses fall into the passive side of the spectrum. And part of the reason why they set this up back then was prior to 1986, there were a lot of high net worth individuals, say, we'll say doctors and lawyers, I'll pick on those guys, that were wiping out their large, you know, considerable W-2 salaries and whatnot by making huge investments in real estate. And they weren't very involved with the actual operations of the property. They were just the ones buying the property. So they came up with this rule to say, okay, if you are investing in rental real estate, we're going to say all rental real estate by default is passive. And any of this other type of income, like you have like a W-2 or you have a law practice, dental practice, something like that, where you're actively working in it day to day, that's going to fall on this non-passive side of the spectrum. And what they said is that if you have passive losses, they can only offset passive income. Now, a few years later, there was a lot of stir about this because there were a lot of people who were full-time in real estate, you know, whether they were real estate agents or investing in rental properties and flipping properties or wholesaling properties full-time. They said, you know, this is very unfair to us because we are in this industry day in and day out. We're not just doing it on the side. We're not just, you know, buying up all these properties and being fully passive. So in 1993, Congress established the rules for qualifying as a real estate professional, which would allow you to use rental losses, actually recharacterize them as non-passive losses. So you could offset things like ordinary income, other business income, W-2 income, and stuff like that. So that is something that a lot of our clients are seeking or trying to achieve, is qualifying as a real estate professional, because what they want to do is, yeah, we love being able to offset the rental income with the depreciation deductions. But what can be even better is if we can, like we said before, you can generate losses where you're exceeding rental income with these depreciation deductions. Well, that generates a tax loss. But if you're not qualifying as a real estate professional, those losses are considered passive and they get suspended, meaning that they get carried forward until a future year when you do have more passive income that can absorb them. But if you're qualifying as a real estate professional, you don't have to suspend them and carry them forward. You can use the losses to offset your W-2 and other forms of business income. What is phenomenal with this particular strategy is that in the IRS and the IRS's view in the tax code, they look at married couples as one taxpayer. So what that means is you can have one spouse who works, you know, 50 hours a week in their W-2 job. Maybe they're, you know, in a higher W-2, like 32, 35, 37% kind of tax bracket there, while the other spouse is focusing on real estate and qualifying for real estate professional status. So that they can effectively pair those two things together. And this spouse who's qualifying as a real estate professional can generate a lot of these large tax losses with depreciation. And since they're treated as one taxpayer, they can offset the other spouse's W-2 income. The reason why I say it's very often utilized by married couples or spouses is because one of the rules for real estate professional status is that, or the main rule is that you have to spend at least 750 hours in a real property trade or business. 750 is not necessarily even full time. It's about 15 hours a week. But the second piece is you got to spend more than half your total working hours in real property trades. So that means if you have some kind of non-real estate related, relatively full-time job, you're going to get disqualified by that second component, even if you're spending 800, 900 hours in your real estate business. But it makes it a lot more flexible if you have a spouse who does not have a full-time W-2 job, can focus solely on real estate. That way they can keep it, you know, to focus on just achieving that, I don't want to say bare minimum, but the minimum of 750 hours, as opposed to trying to also overcome how many hours they're spending in like a part-time job.
In another job. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, so the way I would explain it, and then we'll move into the legislation, and we'll do that quickly. But let's say a person has a W-2 job of $100,000. And I think this gets to the crux of the matter. I think if you make $100,000 and you have in a regular job, and then you have a rental property in which you're earning say $20,000, and you have $20,000 in expenses, just to keep it simple, not including depreciation, but you could if you were a real estate professional and you had the ability to have an additional, just keep it simple, $10,000 in depreciation, then you would, if you were a real estate professional, you would be allowed, that would be a loss on the rental property of $10,000, right? $20,000 exactly. Minus $20,000 in expenses minus $10,000 in depreciation. So you'd have a loss of $10,000 that you would be able to apply against your $100,000 W-2 job and only pay taxes, very simply, on $90,000. If you weren't a real estate professional, you would pay taxes on $100,000, your full W-2 job, and your earnings, your rental property would essentially be break even for tax return purposes. $20,000 minus $20,000 in expenses, and the depreciation would be suspended. That additional loss would be suspended. And basically, you don't get to offset the losses from the real estate against your other earnings.
That is correct. And I'm glad you kind of threw out some of those numbers there, too, because this is one of the other minor exceptions to that rule, is that if your adjusted gross income is $100,000 or less, you're allowed, and it's literally called an allowance. So this is where you don't have to qualify as a real estate professional in order to take the losses. However, the losses are limited to $25,000. So if you were in that exact, you know, scenario where you had $100,000 of W-2 income, even if you weren't a real estate professional, if you had that $10,000 loss from the rental property, you actually would be able to use that because you're beneath that $25,000 loss threshold. However, that $25,000 allowance, it starts to phase out when your adjusted gross income, and for most people, adjusted gross income, think about like just your taxable income. There's some other things that tweak in there, but once you get over 100,000, though, that starts to phase out, and it fully phases out once you get to 150,000 of AGI. So, and it literally is on like a linear scale. So if you're, to make that simple, if you get up to $125,000 of adjusted gross income, then the maximum amount of passive loss allowance you would be permitted to take would be 12,500, because you're halfway to that full phase out threshold. So, and it's kind of a sliding scale in there as you get closer to 150.
All right. Wow. Well, you can see the need to have a tax professional to help you with all of this. Good luck remembering all that otherwise when you're also doing other things. So can we keep it to 2 minutes, Justin? Keep the audience. I want to raise awareness of a couple things in the tax world. One of them being the new BOI reporting, and it might be as simple as find a professional and read up on it. We're probably not going to be able to dive into that real deeply. If you want to touch on the depreciation, you sort of touched on that with the bonus depreciation, but give the audience a quick update on that legislation.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the pending legislation where we keep alluding to is, and the bill actually just went to the floor a few days ago before this recording. It's January 24th right now. So it's likely going to go through multiple iterations of, you know, edits and things like that as Congress tries to compromise. But in its current state, it would restore bonus depreciation back up to 100%. It would actually make it retroactive for 2023. So it's 60% in 2024. It was 80% in 2023. But if they pass this in time, it could actually make 2023 go up to 100% in addition to 2024 and 2025 being 100%. So that's pretty huge for us on the investing side. There's also some minor adjustments they're wanting to make to the child tax credit. A lot of those actually have been weaned out in the most recent version of the bill. So there are still some pending changes on that, but nothing super exciting. One other thing that I thought was kind of interesting that they had in there, too, is they want to raise the 1099 reporting threshold. Currently, it's at $600. They want to raise it up to $1,000, which would be kind of nice. For those of you that aren't aware, if you pay some professional out of your business for some kind of services, if you pay them more than $600 a year, you have to issue them a document in January called a 1099 NEC. So that would alleviate a little bit of reporting for some people. And there's some exceptions to the rule, like if the person you're paying is a corporation or if you pay them with a credit card, things like that. But so that would affect almost everybody that is investing in real estate is probably familiar with 1099s. If you're not, I'd definitely talk to your tax advisor, tax preparer about that. Something you should probably be doing on an annual basis. Now, the other part, and this is something that is not being debated, has actually already been passed. It was actually passed back in 2021, but they delayed the implementation of it for COVID. thanks, COVID, for all the things that you gave us.
Yeah, another thing.
But it finally went into full swing. And this is in its additional reporting requirements that the Financial Crime and Enforcement Network, it's FinCEN is their acronym, F-I-N-C-E-N. And the Financial Crimes and Enforcement Network wants everyone who has any, pretty much any kind of entity to do some additional reporting. And they're calling it the Beneficial Owner Information Report. It's essentially who are all the beneficial owners, or what you could kind of think of who are all the owners of an LLC. And so this is, unfortunately, some bad news for a lot of investors that have dozens of LLCs. They'll have a lot of these reports to submit because you have to do one for each LLC that you own. As of right now, most in like the tax and legal community, most of the CPAs that we've talked to, there's a lot of chatter in the AICPA about this as well. But most CPA firms are taking the position that they will not file these reports, and because it falls more under the what's considered to be a practice of law, and CPA firms are specifically prohibited from practicing law. So. We can do tax returns all day, but we can't get into anything that's like considered legal practice. So definitely would recommend talking to your attorney about that, about filing these reports. You can self-file them on FinCEN's website. They've actually released a decent amount of information, FAQs and things like that on their portal. But the big thing that you need to know is that any entities that you had registered prior to 2024, they have until December 31st of 2024 to complete this reporting. If you register an LLC, though, in 2024, just any time during 2024, you only have 90 days to complete that reporting. So it's a relatively quick turnaround. It's not something that you want to put off. If anything, it's what is probably going to become commonplace is most people are probably going to register with the IRS and Secretary of State and then immediately go to doing their BOI reporting in most cases. Mm-hmm. And then when we get into 2025, the crazier part is any entities registered in 2025 will have 30 days to file their BOI report. It kind of has this like stair stepping down as far as the how quick of a turnaround you have to do on these reports.
Right. Presumably by then there will be more awareness of it. But I think the point is... Mm-hmm. If you haven't heard about these issues, then start paying attention and look up, call your tax advisor, call us, whatever, and dive into it with some more detail. But know that it applies to you, and it's not something that just applies to somebody else. Well, this has been a great conversation. We could go on and on forever, we'll need to leave it there, and we really appreciate it. A couple of the lessons that I come away with is the importance of tax planning, the importance of talking to a tax professional to navigate through some of these things in an accurate and planned way. Pay attention to some of the details. What's another lesson that you have, Justin, that's sort of a high level piece of advice?
Yeah, I know it's a little self-serving. We would say, you know, it's never too early to get started on tax planning. And just in general, your options are so much more numerous before a transaction has occurred. Like, you know, Carl kind of said earlier today in the podcast, is, you know, if you don't cut yourself off at the knees, what I like to say. Make sure you're giving yourself plenty of options. You know, talk to a tax advisor sooner rather than later to help you kind of plan and guide around this stuff.
Well, that's fantastic. Where can we find more out about Justin? I'll tell you here. If you go to the website, if you don't mind me reading this, Justin,
therealestatecpa.com.
And then if you do a backslash and just type in his name, Justin Shore, you'll find more out about Justin there. Also taxsmartinvestors.com/welcome. And I'm a listener of their firm's podcast. I usually listen to it on a podcast, the Real Estate Tax CPA. They've actually rolled out others. Justin is a frequent guest host on that show, as well as others. And so it's a great podcast to listen to get tidbits there. Well, thank you very much, Justin, for being a guest today. And of course, personally, it's always just a great pleasure to talk with you. Very briefly, as we wrap this up, wanted to just give a shout out to the sponsor of this podcast, Infinity Commercial Capital. We help people find money. We're lenders, financing advisors, providing permanent bridge and construction capital solutions for commercial enterprises. And I define commercial enterprises as everything from 1 to 4 unit residential rental properties, multifamily properties, to all manners of what we conventionally consider commercial properties. Our main value propositions include the fact that we represent the borrower and find the right capital solution for the borrower. We feature a 30-year fixed rate permanent commercial solution. That longer amortization means lower debt service payments. We also offer bridge loans for residential and commercial properties. And finally, simplified underwriting, which is a huge thing when you're navigating through a loan process. No tax returns, no personal debt to income ratios, no global cash flow analysis, et cetera. So we're proud of our programs, and we'd love to chat with you more about that. You can find more out about us at infinitycomcapital.com. Call us at 314-403-7745. Email info@infinitycomcapital.com. You can also find us on all manners of social media. We're everywhere. Wherever you look for social media, you can find us. We do frequently post education bits and current rates, et cetera. So we do try to keep that up. Like our show on video or YouTube, video or the podcast platform, so that you can follow our future content. If you have questions or feedback for me, for Justin, we'll make sure we monitor those and respond to those and get your questions answered. If you want to be a guest on the show, let us know. I'll just wrap it with saying thank you for watching or listening. We really appreciate it. We have some great content coming up. We're talking to a realtor very soon. We're going to talk to another financing advisor about equity fundraising very soon, and we'll be bringing up some other content. So thank you very much, and enjoy your day. Bye-bye.
Questions, comments, want to be a guest? You can reach Carl at kbaker@infinitycomcapital.com. You can find all episodes of Infinite Returns Commercial Real Estate Investing on all major podcast platforms and YouTube. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, happy investing.